Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Exodus chapter 4. I'm going to do the entire chapter, verses 1 through 31. I'm going to entitle this section, Moses' Three Signs for the Hebrew Slaves. Our context is this. In the previous chapter, chapter 3, we saw Moses meeting the angel of Jehovah at the burning bush in the desert of Midian near Mount Horeb / Sinai. In the southeastern corner of the Sinai Desert, that's where he was then. He's still there at the beginning of chapter 4. We'll look at the first five verses now of Exodus 4. Then Moses said, "What if they will not believe me or listen to what I say?" He's referring to the Hebrew slaves when he goes to tell them to deliver the message that God has told Moses to tell them. And Moses says, "What if they don't believe me or listen to me? For they may say, 'The Lord has not appeared to you.'" The Lord said to him, "What is that in your hand?" And he, Moses, said, "A staff." Then God said, "Throw it on the ground." So Moses threw it on the ground, and it became a serpent, and Moses fled from it. But the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand and grasp it by its tail." So he stretched out his hand and caught it, and it became a staff in his hand, that they may believe that the Lord, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has appeared to you. Now, there are going to be three signs given in this chapter, and we need to distinguish these three signs from the 10 plagues, the 10 signs on Egypt. The three signs here are signs for the Hebrews to believe, the 10 plagues in Egypt, or the 10 signs for the Egyptians to believe. Now, Moses, still at the burning bush here, asked the Lord, after he's been commissioned by the Lord to go to the Hebrews, Moses asked, "What if they will not believe me or listen to what I say?" This is Moses' third expression of reluctance in spite of God's assurance in Exodus 3:18 at the burning bush in the last chapter, which I'll read now. "They will pay heed to what you say," God says to Moses. They're going to listen to you. "And you, with the elders of Israel, will come to the king of Egypt, and you will say to him, 'Da da 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 da, let us go sacrifice in the wilderness.' They will pay heed to what you say." Well, I've collected the four times where Moses says, "I don't really believe that, Lord." First of all, in Exodus 3:13, before God gave him God's assurance, in Exodus 3:13, Moses said to God, "Behold, I'm going to the sons of Israel, and I will say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you.' Now they may say to me, 'What is his name? What shall I say to them?'" There's a first, "I'm not so sure." They might ask for God's name, and I don't know what it is. And then God gives the assurance in Exodus 3:18, and then in Exodus 4:1, Moses said, "What if they will not believe me or listen to what I say? For they may say, 'The Lord has not appeared to you.'" And then in Exodus 4:10, then Moses said to the Lord, "Please, Lord, I have never been eloquent, neither recently nor in time past, nor since you have spoken to your servant, for I am slow of speech and slow of tongue." And then three verses later in Exodus 4:13, but he said, "Please, Lord, now send the message by whomever you will, but not me," is what he's saying. So he first asked God, "What am I going to say to him?" Then he says, "Well, what if they don't believe me when I say it to them?" And the next thing he says, "Well, I'm slow-tongued. I can't say it well." And then he finally says, "Why don't you send somebody else?" Now, this reluctance might have been understandable on Moses' part, but John Gill says it can hardly be thought that so good a man and so great a prophet as Moses was would directly fly in the face of God and expressly contradict what he had said. Well, that might be so, but God lets us express our fears and concerns to him. I mean, this was a very tough thing for some unknown guy to walk into the Pharaoh's palace and says, "Pharaoh, let my people go." I mean, come on. That takes a lot of guts. Well, John Gill says that I don't think there's any contradiction here, but if you think this is a if someone thinks that there's a contradiction here that a great man like Moses would show such diffidence when asked to do a task, we can look at Exodus 3:18 and notice that the elders, 3:18 says that the elders will heed Moses' words, but here Moses is referring to all the people, in other words, or the great prophet Moses believed he convinced the elders, but he couldn't, not going to convince the whole mass of the slaves. That's John Gill's idea. I don't buy that. I think that he was just recognizing a plain fact that neither people nor leaders would believe without a sign. He needs a sign. He needs somehow for them to convince him because they're not going to believe me, which is exactly true. It's not a lack of faith to ask God how God plans to do something that's on the surface is impossible. It's not a lack of faith. Besides, after what happened to Moses 40 years before, it was understandable that he was reluctant. Remember, 40 years before, he slew the Egyptian taskmaster, and then he tried to break up a fight between two Hebrew slaves, and one of the slaves objected to Moses' attempts at mediation and said, "Who made you a ruler over us?" So yeah, it's understandable that Moses would be a little reluctant. God didn't reprove Moses for his reluctance. Well, I think at one time at the end he finally got a little upset, but initially God didn't. He gave him signs. He said, don't worry about it. We're going to have some signs here lined up. We're going to convince these Hebrew elders and the Hebrew slaves. So the first sign is the staff. It's probably a shepherd's crook, as the NIV Study Bible says. Throws it on the ground, becomes a snake. Now, some people say that in reality it was turned into a snake, and some people say, no, it was an illusion, like occultists sometimes do. I don't see how that could be an illusion. I mean, if it was an illusion, Moses ran from it. It scared him. I think this is actual. Now, that's a heap big miracle there, to take a stick, and turn it into a snake. Now, there's a little bit of symbolism in this snake. The snake is a serpent. A serpent, of course, is the traditional symbol of Satan ever since the Garden of Eden. Moses grabbed the tail of that snake, and John Gill says that showed that Moses had the power over that snake. He had power over Satan. Even though Moses, I might add, this is me, not John Gill, Moses actually fled temporarily. Great application here. You see the devil, he scares you, you run, you collect your courage, your thoughts. The reality of the situation is you have control, you turn around and grab the snake by the tail, and that's the end of that. Now, here's some speculations as to why God chose this first sign of the snake. Egyptian conjurers knew such a trick and would be tempted to imitate it. After which, God's serpent would eat theirs up, which is what happened later. That's the pulpit commentary's idea. It could be, you know, God can think ahead like we can't. Now, the fact that Moses fled from the snake, this helps show that Moses wrote this account here in Exodus. He would remember vividly such a small detail, as Ellicott says. And not only that, it shows him to be afraid, which is not exactly to his credit. So he recorded something that was a little bit, made him look a little bad there. Moses wrote this. Now, when God told Moses to grab the tail of the snake, to grasp the tail of the snake, God is showing Moses that Moses had nothing to fear. But Adam Clark makes the point, it took a lot of faith for Moses to grab that snake. And I'll tell you, I know people who grab snakes. I don't know whether this snake was a poisonous snake or not. The commentators go on and on about what kind of snake it was. Nobody knows. It's just, I think that Hebrew is just a generic word for a snake, so I don't know. But if it was poisonous, I'd be scared to grab the tail of a snake. Grab a rattlesnake or a copperhead by the tail. Oh my gosh, I couldn't do that. But even if it's not poisonous, I couldn't do it. I know I got a friend that used to live out here. He out here in the country. He would walk around with snakes. He had one living under his house, big old 6-foot snake curled up under his house. Some people are like that. But I think Moses, I think he was, you know, we can say, well, he's timid because he won't convince the Hebrew slaves. Well, he wasn't timid enough to where he wouldn't pick that snake up. We go to Exodus 4, verses 6 through 9. The Lord furthermore said to him, now put your hand into your bosom. So he put his hand into his bosom, and when he took it out, behold, his hand was leprous like snow. Then God said, put your hand into your bosom again. So Moses put his hand into his bosom again, and when he took it out of his bosom, behold, it was restored like the rest of his flesh. God is now speaking, if they will not believe you or heed the witness of the first sign, they may believe the witness of the last sign. In other words, if they're not going to believe the snake, believe your leper's hand getting healed. Verse 9, Exodus 4, but if they will not believe even these two signs or heed what you say, then you shall take some water from the Nile and pour it on the dry ground, and the water which you take from the Nile will become blood on the dry ground. All right, so now we come to the second sign. Moses puts his hand into his bosom, onto his chest, underneath his clothes there, and take it out. It was leprous like snow, and white leprosy was the worst kind, the most difficult to be cured. It's very obvious. Now, that sign was miraculous in two ways, as John Gill says. First of all, the leprosy afflicted only one part of the body. He had a leprous hand, and the rest of his body was well. That's not normal. That's supernatural. And also that the leprosy, of course, was cured immediately. Now, it's interesting that all three of these signs showed God's power through Moses. The first sign, he had power over the devil when he grabbed that snake by the tail and it turned back to a rod. Also, when the rod was changed to the serpent, that shows that Moses is able to take an innocuous object and turn it into something that's able to chastise and destroy. So the idea is, little meek and mild Moses is going to chastise and destroy Egypt if you don't listen to me. The second sign shows that Moses had power over sickness. Or God had power over sickness through Moses. The third sign was that God has power over the enemies of God, namely the Egyptians, because you take blood, you take water, which is life, prosperity, turns into blood, that stands for calamity, suffering, and bloodshed. So peace and prosperity water, the water of life, turns into calamity, suffering, and bloodshed, as Ellicott, the commentator, says. So these three sides are sort of interesting, especially when you consider that it was water from the Nile. Water from the Nile was actually the life of Egypt, as anybody who's read about 2 minutes of Egyptian history knows. Egypt was famous for being dependent on the flooding of the Nile. The water from the Nile symbolizes the life of Egypt, and it's poured on the ground, it becomes blood, it becomes death. We go now to Exodus 4, verses 10 through 12. Then Moses said to the Lord, "Please, Lord, I have never been eloquent, neither recently nor in time past, nor since you have spoken to your servant, for I am slow of speech and slow of tongue." The Lord said to him, "Who has made man's mouth? Or who makes him mute or deaf or seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now then go, and I, even I, will be with your mouth and teach you what you are to say." This is Moses' fourth expression of reluctance. I've already mentioned those four before you. I mentioned a while ago, I won't read them again, but this emphasizes the fact that Moses just really doesn't want to do this. He says he's slow of speech. Well, the Apostle Paul said the same thing, 2 Corinthians 10:10. "For they say his letters," that means Paul's opponents, "say about Paul, his letters are weighty and strong, but his personal presence is unimpressive and his speech contemptible." Isn't it ironic? Two of the most influential persons on this planet in all of human history were slow-tongued. They stumbled over their speech. They were not impressive orators. And the reason that God mentions the mouth, who made the mouth, who made man's mouth, was because God is saying, look, if I can make man's mouth, I can make it speak well too. Now we read in Acts 7:22, as Stephen recounts Old Testament history to his persecutors, Stephen says this, "Moses was educated in all the learning of the Egyptians, and he was a man of power in words and deeds." Now, immediately we think, well, that doesn't sound like Moses was slow-tongued. Was he just being modest when he's talking to God? He was a man of power in words. Now, there's three ways of solving this apparent contradiction, as Adam Clark says. Option number one, Moses overcame a natural infirmity, a speech impediment, after God appointed him. I don't think so. Option number two, Moses didn't know Hebrew well. That's why he was slow of tongue, because Hebrew was not his first language. He was 80 years in Egypt, 80 years in Midian. Where did I get 80 years from? It's more like 40 years in Egypt, 40 years in Midian. There was no good Hebrew to be found, and so God had to help him learn better Hebrew. That's Adam Clark's idea. I don't think so. I think the best answer is that Stephen in Acts 7:22 is not talking about clarity of speech or fluency of speech. He's talking about power of speech. The fact that when Moses spoke, powerful things happened. The plagues came, or the plagues were stayed. So we read Acts 7:22 this way. He was a man of power, because when he spoke, miracles happened. Now one more problem here. God says, who makes man mute or deaf or blind? Oh, a good God? How can a good God do evil and make somebody not be able to talk or see or hear? Well, the answer to that, in my opinion, is that if God makes an evil person mute, deaf, or blind, that's a good thing, not evil. I mean, I wish God had made Adolf Hitler blind. That would be a good thing, not a bad thing. So we're not going to get God on that. We're not going to say, oh, God, you're evil. No, it's mankind that's evil. Now, God will do bad things to people for judgment. So in that sense, he's the author of evil, when he's evil to the people that are receiving the judgment. But it's not evil in the scheme of things about how God has to run a universe full of wretched human sin and rebellion. We go now to Exodus 4, verses 13 through 17. But he, Moses, said, "Please, Lord, now send the message by whomever you will." He's saying, they won't believe me. I don't know what your name is. They won't believe me. I'm slow-tongued. And finally, he doesn't even give an excuse. He just says, send somebody else. Then the anger of the Lord burned against Moses. I guess God's patience finally wore out after the forced protestation of reluctance. Then the anger of the Lord burned against Moses, and he said, "Is there not your brother Aaron the Levite? I know that he speaks fluently. And moreover, behold, he's coming out to meet you. When he sees you, he would be glad in his heart. You are to speak to him and put the words in his mouth, and I, even I, will be with your mouth and his mouth, and I will teach you what you are to do. Moreover, he shall speak for you to the people, and he will be as a mouth for you, and you will be as God to him. You shall take in your hand the staff with which you shall perform the signs." So this is Moses' fourth expression of reluctance to do the job. He said, send whomever you will. And John Gill and Adam Clark say that many ancient and modern commentators think that Moses is asking for the Messiah to do the job, that the idea of the Messiah is in the minds of the Hebrew people, and Moses is looking for that Messiah. I don't really think so. John Gill says, no, he's just asking for someone in general, somebody else besides him. Now, God gets angry at Moses. This shows that Moses is a faithful historian to record an incident that makes him look bad. It makes him look pretty bad. You have God get mad at you after you've just been talking to him face to face? But God is not so angry as to completely remove Moses from the task. Some people, Jameson Foss and Brown point this out, some people say that the office of priesthood here is transferred from Moses to Aaron because Moses is kicking so hard. I don't know. Nice speculation. The way I look at it is that Moses' reluctance may have been reasonable at first, as I pointed out to you. He had a lot of reasons to be reluctant, but he went on too long about it. Well, why should he be reluctant? Well, he's a nobody. He's a shepherd in Midian. He's been gone for 40 years. Nobody knows who he was, that he was the adopted daughter of a Pharaoh. Nobody knows that. He was wanted for murder. He's going to be asking the impossible, to ask that all the Hebrews be let to go out into the wilderness. Sure, he was reluctant, but he went on too long about it because God was saying, no, you go do this. Now, God told Moses that when Aaron shows up out of Goshen, goes out to Mount Horeb in the desert of Midian, God says that Aaron will be glad in his heart to see Moses. This is to assure Moses, your brother, of course, he hadn't seen his brother in 40 years. He's going to say, yeah, there's going to be a happy reunion, and everything's going to be just fine. He's going to be with you. He says that just as God speaks to the prophets speak to the people. Well, he didn't say that. He says that Aaron will be a mouth for you, and you, Moses, will be as God to him. And what that means is just as God speaks to the prophets speak to the people. Just as Moses speaks to Aaron, Moses will be like God speaking to prophet. Aaron will be like a prophet then speaking out the words of God. The analogy is completely square on there. And then God says in verse 17, you shall take in your hand this staff with which you shall perform the signs. That staff's going to show up a lot in the future story here. God may have been guarding against Aaron co-opting Moses' leadership, John Gill suggests. So God is telling Moses, carry that staff because that staff is a sign of your authority. Aaron's going to be your mouthpiece, but he's not going to be your boss. I don't know if that's true or not, but interesting idea. We go to Exodus 4, verses 18 through 20. Then Moses departed and returned to Jethro, his father-in-law, and said to him, please let me go that I may return to my brethren who are in Egypt and see if they are still alive. And Jethro said to Moses, go in peace. Now the Lord said to Moses in Midian, go back to Egypt, for all the men who were seeking your life are dead. So Moses took his wife and his sons and mounted them on a donkey and returned to the land of Egypt. Moses also took the staff of God in his hand. See, there's that staff again, always mentioned. That's the symbol of his authority. Now Moses was very polite to talk to Jethro. First of all, I'm sure he went out of the desert in southeast Sinai, near Mount Sinai, went over across the northern top of the Gulf of Aqaba and went down into present-day southern Jordan and northern Saudi Arabia over there. That was the land of Midian. That's where he went back to see Jethro, his father-in-law. Jethro's also named Reuel, as you recall. Now, here's some reasons why Moses didn't tell Jethro why he was going. He was polite to ask because, after all, Moses was in Jethro's service, but he didn't tell Jethro why he was going. This is all from John Gill. First of all, he didn't tell Jethro because it wasn't any of Jethro's business why he was going. Jethro's not a Hebrew. When it says that Moses was going back to see if, when Moses told Jethro he was going back to see if any of his brethren were still alive, I think he's talking about his immediate family, not the whole nation of Hebrew slaves, because I think that Jethro would have known that the Hebrew slaves were still alive, obviously, because there were so many of them, but he's talking about his blood brethren. So it wasn't Jethro's business, family business, Hebrew business. Jethro's neither one. He wanted to keep Jethro from making arguments against going because, you know, he's been a good shepherd. And it's also his grandsons are going to be gone too, because, and his daughter Zipporah. He didn't want them to go. And by not telling Jethro what he was planning, that would keep Jethro from saying, whoa, 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 don't do that. Especially if Jethro knew completely what Moses was planning, to take all those slaves out into the desert to worship and maybe even to flee Egypt. Whoa, he's going to balk over that for sure. Maybe Moses didn't tell Jethro because Moses was modest. He didn't want to tell Jethro of all the visions that he had had. And God made me leader of all the Hebrew slaves. He might think, Jethro's not going to buy that one. So I'm not going to say anything about that. I don't want to sound braggadocious. Another reason he might not have told Jethro is because Moses wanted to keep his plans secret. If Jethro leaked Moses' plans, what's going to happen to Moses? He's going to be seen as a rebel and a traitor by the Egyptian government, and they're probably going to take him in, execute him. So Moses says, I just want to go see about my brethren. He didn't mention about not returning. He didn't mention that he wasn't going to return. Actually, on the Exodus, he did go by there and drop off his Zipporah and his kids, so they didn't go on the Exodus with him. But he didn't tell Jethro that he wasn't planning to come back, even though he was going to take Jethro's two grandsons away from him. That would have raised a stink, too. Now, verse 19 says that all the people who knew about Moses in Egypt were dead. It's been 40 years. They have time to die. All those people who were trying to kill Moses because he had killed the Hebrew taskmaster, if you recall. And he took his two sons with him. He took his sons. He only had two. The first son is Gershom. We read about that in Exodus 2:22. Then she gave birth to a son. That's Zipporah, the mother, the daughter of Reuel, also known as Jethro. Reuel/Jethro had Zipporah, and Zipporah married Moses, and Zipporah had a son, and Moses named that son Gershom, which means desolate. For he said, I've been a sojourner in a foreign land. Isn't that a great name for a son? Come here, desolate, to remind him that he's living in a foreign land. The second son was Eliezer. Now, his name is not mentioned until Exodus 18:4, which says this, the other son was named Eliezer. For he said, the God of my father was my help and helped me from the sword of Pharaoh. I think Eliezer has something to do with help. So those are the two sons that he took with him out of Midian, going back to Goshen in Egypt. But the fact that he took those two sons, that shows that he had no intent to come back to Midian. That might have tipped Jethro off. Why is he taking my grandsons away? Now in verse 20, he got a donkey ready. He mounted his wife and sons on a donkey. Now think about it. Two sons and a wife on one donkey? That's not going to be very probable. The Septuagint has it in the plural, which makes more sense, as Adam Clark says, because it would take more than one ass to carry a wife and two sons. But I don't think the singular is a problem. You could say he mounted them on a donkey each individually. He put one on a donkey, the other on a donkey, and the other on another donkey. Three donkeys, two sons, and one wife. So he mounted them on a donkey and returned to the land of Egypt. Moses also took the staff of God in his hand. Why is it called the staff of God? Because that rod had been appropriated to God's service. It was going to be turned into a serpent to show the Hebrews, and so it's called the staff of God. Also, Moses used it for the plagues, too, on Egypt. We now move on to Exodus chapter 4, verse 21. The Lord said to Moses, that's Yahweh, said to Moses, when you go back to Egypt, see that you perform before Pharaoh all the wonders which I have put in your power. But I will harden his heart so that he will not let the people go. Now, the wonders here, one might think, refers to the three signs that we just talked about. The rod to the snake to the rod, sign one, the leprous hand, sign two, the water to blood, sign three. No, because this is talking about signs before Pharaoh, not the signs before the Hebrew slaves. So this is the 10 plagues that he's talking about, that God is talking about to Moses. Perform these 10 plagues. And then God says, I will harden his heart so that he will not let the people go. And this is what gets everybody all riled up. How can God do that? He didn't give Pharaoh a free choice. God just takes people and makes them decide what God, he violates these people's free will and makes them do what God wants them to do, and God has destroyed our freedom, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Well, we got to look at this properly here. Basically, what he's saying is, I will harden his heart because he's not going to let the people go. In other words, Pharaoh is going to make a decision, a sinful decision, against his people. And as a result of that sin, God will then harden his heart. And as a result of the hardening of his heart, he's not going to let the people go. We can see this because the word harden, referring to Pharaoh's heart is said to be hardened by God 9 times, and it is said to be hardened by Pharaoh himself 9 times. Now, when I say his heart has been hardened by Pharaoh, sometimes these 9 verses are in the passive. It says Pharaoh's heart was hardened. It doesn't say who hardened it, but the assumption is, the strong implication is, it was Pharaoh himself hardened his own heart. So let's look at where God hardens Pharaoh's heart. I'm going to read these real quickly. Exodus 4:21, that is where we are now. I will harden his heart. Exodus 7:3, but I will harden Pharaoh's heart, multiply my signs and wonders. Exodus 9:12, but the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he did not listen to them. Exodus 10:1, then the Lord said to Moses, go to Pharaoh, for I have hardened his heart and the hearts of his officials. Exodus 10:20, but the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart. Exodus 10:27, but the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he was unwilling to let them go. Exodus 11:10, Moses and Aaron did all these wonders before Pharaoh, but the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he would not let the Israelites go. Exodus 14:4, I will harden Pharaoh's heart so that he will pursue them. Exodus 14:8, the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. It's a whole lot of hardening going on. But now let's look at where Pharaoh is said to harden his own heart. Exodus 7:13 through 14. However, Pharaoh's heart was hard, and he did not listen to them as the Lord had said. Then the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh's heart is hard. He refuses to let the people go. So there, Pharaoh's heart is hard before God hardens it even further. Exodus 7:22. But the magicians of Egypt did the same thing by their occult practices, the snake business. So Pharaoh's heart was hard, and he would not listen to them. So the implication is very strongly there that Pharaoh's heart was already hard before God hardened it. Exodus 8:15, but when Pharaoh saw there was relief, he hardened his heart. There it's very clear. It's not implicit, but it's explicit that Pharaoh hardened his own heart. Exodus 8:19, this is the finger of God, the magician said to Pharaoh, but Pharaoh's heart was hard. Exodus 8:32, but Pharaoh hardened his heart. There's explicit again, not implicit. Pharaoh hardened his heart this time, and he did not let the people go. Exodus 9:7, Pharaoh sent messengers who saw that not a single one of the Israelite livestock was dead, but Pharaoh's heart was hard, and he did not let the people go. Exodus 9:34, when Pharaoh saw that the rain, hail, and thunder had ceased, he sinned again and hardened his heart. That was very clear. He sinned and hardened his heart. It was his own fault that God hardened his heart. The hardening of his heart was the judgment for him hardening his own heart. Exodus 9:35, so Pharaoh's heart was hard, and he did not let the Israelites go. So I don't see any theological problem at all there. I used to. I think a lot of it has to do with the way, the style of the writing. God is, in the Old Testament, God, a lot of times human actions are kind of left implied in the background, and God's actions are brought to the foreground, and it makes it look like God is doing everything without any human cooperation. Let me read from Adam Clark. Now, this is a good quote because Adam Clark is an Arminian, unfortunately, but he's quoting Augustine, who's an Augustinian, obviously, to speak anachronistically. He was a Calvinist. And this is what Clark said. Quote, if we take up the subject in a theological point of view, all sober Christians will allow the truth of this proposition of St. Augustine. When the subject in question is a person who has hardened his own heart by frequently resisting the grace and spirit of God. Now, here's the quote from Augustine. God does not harden men by infusing malice into them, but by not imparting mercy to them. And this other, and Clark goes on to say this other quote from Augustine will be as readily credited. Here's the quote from Augustine. God does not work this hardness of heart in man, but he may be said to harden him whom he refuses to soften, to blind him whom he refuses to enlighten, and to repel him whom he refuses to call. It is but just and right that he should withhold these graces which he had repeatedly offered and which the sinner had despised and rejected. Well, now, if Adam Clark, Arminian, and Augustine the Augustinian can agree on this, I think that's pretty nice considering how many times they don't agree. I mean, we all came into the world. We're sinners. You could say, God hardened my heart because I don't repent. Well, that's just the same thing as saying he didn't soften it. In other words, using the style of the Old Testament, harden equals not soften. Let's read Romans 1:24 through 28 and see about all this business about hardening the heart, how Paul the Apostle takes it. Therefore God gave them over in the lust of their hearts to impurity so that their bodies would be dishonored among them. He's talking about homosexuals. For they exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. For this reason, God gave them over to degrading passions, for their women exchanged the natural function for that which is unnatural, and in the same way also the men abandoned the natural function of the woman and burned their desire toward one another. Men with men committing indecent acts and receiving in their own persons the due penalty of the error. I hate to say this on a podcast. I'm sure it's going to get me banned one day by the techno-fascist who control big tech. But this is back when people understood that God created man male and female, and when people go against God, they start getting involved in all these homosexual lusts. And just as they did not see fit to acknowledge God any longer, God gave them over to a depraved mind to do those things which are not proper. God gave them over. He didn't make them homosexuals. He just let them do what they wanted to do. And that's not to say that God can't deliver people from homosexuality. The depraved mind, he does it all the time. In fact, I've been watching some good YouTube videos, testimonies about homosexuals who've seen the light and realized they were engaged in a lifestyle that was killing them. And so then they came and experienced the love of Jesus, and God delivered them from their homosexuality. As hard as it is for that to be done, it's happening. But God didn't make anybody homosexual. They did it themselves. And you can substitute any other sin you want to, adultery, murdering, gossiping, I don't know, anything. Pride. No, we're all that. We're born that way. And so our hard heart is a punishment of God for our sin. Now, Autumn Clark has an optional way to translate this about making Pharaoh's heart hard. He said we can make his heart hardy, bold, daring, and presumptuous. God made Pharaoh act presumptuously and foolishly in resisting the Hebrews. Well, okay, maybe so. But God did not harden Pharaoh's heart as regards eternal salvation, only in respect to letting the Hebrews go, as Adam Clark says. And I say that, hey, only... it's not only Pharaoh's heart, but everybody's heart is hardened against salvation. We're born that way. Original sin. We go now to Exodus 4, verses 22 and 23. Then you shall say to Pharaoh, thus says the Lord, Israel is my son, my firstborn. So I, that's the Lord, said to you, Pharaoh, let my son go, let Israel go, that he, my son Israel, may serve me. But you have refused to let him go. Behold, I, the Lord, will kill your son, Pharaoh, your firstborn. Now think of the guts it took for Moses to say this. Hey, you don't let my people go. My God is going to kill your firstborn son, your heir. Going to wipe him out. Only God could have given him such courage. And it was necessary to have those signs, too, to impress this hard-hearted Pharaoh. The plagues. Now when God says that Israel is his firstborn, he's using the natural idea that was around the custom back then that the firstborn had the right to a double portion. He was favored, in other words. There was a special relationship between the father and the firstborn, and likewise, there's a special relationship between Yahweh and Israel, the Hebrew children. And so Moses continues to relate Yahweh's wishes to the Pharaoh. He says, this is what God's saying, let my son go, let Israel go, that he may serve me. Now, it doesn't say go where. Some say that God is saying, hey, let my Hebrew children go to sacrifice in Goshen, because they can't sacrifice animals sacred to the Egyptians in Egypt, because the Egyptians would get very upset about that. The Egyptians, you know, worshipped every living animal that there was. But that's, I forgot where I read that. That was Adam Clark's idea, but other people don't agree with him. That might be a reason why they wanted to sacrifice in Goshen. There has to be a reason to tell the Pharaoh, we can't sacrifice in Goshen, we have to go out in the wilderness. And that sounds like a reasonable pretext to me. I have another question is, did Moses mean that, or did God mean to tell Moses this, that we need to go sacrifice with, but as Moses said that, did Moses mean we're not going to sacrifice merely, we are going to keep on going and go to Canaan? Or was Moses at this time planning to go out and sacrifice and then come back to Pharaoh, or come back to Goshen? What exactly was in Moses' mind at this point? I'm not really sure. I traditionally have felt that Moses knew what he was doing, that he was trying to deceive the Pharaoh from the get-go, because what's the big deal? You go to Goshen and you come back, you're still slaves. So I think Moses was planning on getting out of Dodge, but he was just giving a pretext to the Pharaoh. Now, when Yahweh says to Pharaoh by means of Moses, I will kill your son, Pharaoh, that sort of adumbrates the 10th plague, remember, when the firstborn of Pharaoh was killed. Now, Pharaoh's son is probably Pharaoh's blood son. John Gill suggests it might be all of Pharaoh's subjects in a civil sense. They were his sons. I don't think so. Well, it could be, but I don't think so. We go now to Exodus 4, verses 24 through 26. Now, it came about at the lodging place on the way that the Lord met Moses and sought to put him to death. Oh, I just love this matter-of-fact narrative. Oh, yeah, he's out there. He's going to check in. Oh, God shows up, wants to kill him after he just says, I'm going to send Moses to be the deliverer of all those 600,000 Hebrew male slaves plus their women and children. Oh, I'm going to kill him. The lodging place on the way, of course, is from Midian, right there in southern Jordan, northern Saudi Arabia, where Moses was with Jethro, on his way to Egypt, some lodging place, and God shows up, and God is not happy. Now, the obvious reason is because Moses had failed to circumcise his son. Doesn't say which son it is. It's either Gershom or Eliezer. Ellicott says it was Eliezer. Clark says we can't be sure. I'm not going to worry about that too much. The point was he hadn't circumcised one of his sons, and God's angry about it. Now, circumcision was a big deal to God. Breaking a covenant was a serious thing with God, and that's why God was getting ready to put him to death. And all through the Old Testament, you see, you don't mess with God. He's holy. You got to take him seriously. And the people in the Old Testament did not take him seriously. He was just one of many regional gods. And, well, I can, you know, I can do it this way or that way. Like Korah's rebellion, you know, offering strange fowl on the altar. Oh, we're not going to do it God's way. We're going to do it our way. You don't do that with God. Don't touch the ark, God said. So the ark's about to fall off. They put their hands on it. Zap. So the same idea here. Moses is about to get put to death because of not circumcising his son. Let's read that circumcision covenant, Genesis 17, 9 through 14, just so we can drive home how important this was to God. God said further to Abraham, "Now as for you, you shall keep my covenant, you and your descendants after you throughout their generations." That would include Moses. "This is my covenant which you shall keep between me and you and your descendants after you," and your descendants, that would include Gershom or Eliezer. "Every male among you shall be circumcised, and you shall be circumcised in the flesh of your foreskin, and it shall be the sign of the covenant between me and you." See, circumcision is the sign of that famous Genesis 15 covenant. It's the sign, so you do it. "And every male among you who is 8 days old shall be circumcised throughout your generations. A servant who was born in the house or is bought with money from any foreigner who is not of your descendants," they got to be circumcised too. "A servant who is born in your house or who is bought with your money shall surely be circumcised. Thus shall my covenant be in your flesh for an everlasting covenant." In your flesh is the sign. It extends not only to your children, but to your male people in the house. "But an uncircumcised male who is not circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin, that person shall be cut off from his people," i.e. killed. "He has broken my covenant." Cut off can mean excommunicated, but it can also mean killed. I think in this case it means killed. At any rate, Moses was about to get killed because he'd broken the covenant. John Gill came up with some screwy idea. He mentions it. I don't know if he believes it. It says that Moses had stayed so long at the inn, he had delayed to do his work, and God was angry with him, wanted to kill him because he was slow. Well, I don't believe that for a minute. Now, let's look at Moses' situation. Why had he not circumcised his son before? John Gill suggests Moses may have adopted the practice of the Ishmaelites, which was not to circumcise until age 13. I don't know how Gill knows that, unless just he knows the practice of the Arabs in that area in the Middle East. They wait till 13, but Israelites were supposed to circumcise on day 8, not year 13. Could have been that Gershom or Eliezer was very young and Moses wanted to wait until they got to Egypt before he circumcised him. Didn't want to circumcise him on the road. And Ellicott points out a similar idea. If Moses is in a hurry to get to Egypt, he would have to wait for days at that inn while his son healed up. Of course, you know, he could have circumcised the son in Midian before he even left, waited for him to heal up before he got on the road. I don't know. For whatever reason, he didn't do it. Maybe he was just negligent. Now, how did God threaten Moses with death? Maybe serious illness? I can imagine being in an inn on the road, getting Montezuma's revenge in your gut. You think you're going to die? Somebody speculated that maybe God appeared to Moses in a terrible manner, like an angel with a drawn sword in his hand and saying, you've had it, Moses. You're going down. I don't know, but at any rate, Moses realized he was about to die. Jameson Fawcett Brown said that this incident impressed on Moses forever the importance of circumcision for Israel. Now, the NIV Study Bible has an interesting idea here. It's usually Gill that comes up with these crazy ideas. This time it's the NIV Study Bible. It says that in regard to the word feet, Zipporah cut off her son's foreskin and threw it at Moses' feet. The NIV Study Bible says that that word feet is probably a euphemism for genitals. So what Zipporah did was cut off her son's foreskin and threw it at Moses' injing. Well, that seems sort of strange to me. Why would you do that? I find it real hard to believe. Well, the way the NIV Study Bible comes to this conclusion is by looking at Deuteronomy 28:57, which is part of the curses here. "And toward her afterbirth, which issues from between her legs," that word legs is the word for feet, same Hebrew word, "from between her legs, between her feet, and toward her children whom she bears, for she will eat them secretly for lack of anything else. If you sin, you're going to be so hungry, you're going to eat your afterbirth and the children. The NIV Study Bible says that because legs is feet here, it really means the womb. Anything which comes out between your legs is that which is coming out of the womb, which of course is the genitals. And therefore, feet here in this passage is talking about Moses' genitals. Well, folks, that's a stretch for me. I don't believe that. I believe she threw it right at his feet, the feet that have the 10 toes. Now she said in verse 25, "You are indeed a bridegroom of blood to me." Now, we tend to want to read that in anger, that she read it and that she said it in anger. That's not necessarily so. Here's some options as to her tone of voice. First, she was angry. Why was she angry? Because Moses was not only putting Moses' life at risk, he was also risking cutting Zipporah's son off from the covenant, i.e. killed. He was risking Zipporah's son's life, and she was mad about it. Remember, Genesis 17:14, "But an uncircumcised male who is not circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin, that person shall be cut off from his people." Now, I guarantee the Zipporah knew that provision in the famous Genesis 17 circumcision covenant. You know she knew it, because I'm sure Moses had trained her. These people were patriarchs. They had oral traditions. They carried this idea forward. So she knew. She was mad at Moses because she put her son, and you know, a mama and her son, dad, you're going to put my son at risk like that? And I think that's what it is. But there's another option, is that she's congratulating Moses. She's thankful that through the blood of circumcision, she saved Moses' life. So we would read it like this. "You are indeed a bridegroom of blood to me." In other words, that blood is, you're a husband, and you're a husband whose blood has made me safe. I don't believe that for a minute. I think she was mad as hops. Verse 26, "So he," God, "let him," Moses, "alone." Let him alone. At that time, she said, Zipporah said, "You are a bridegroom of blood because of the circumcision." Well, that's an interesting phrase, bridegroom of blood. Now, I've just said that she's probably angry. I think, obviously, she was angry. She wasn't congratulating Moses on anything. She's angry. Here's some options as to why she was angry. The NIV Study Bible says that the circumcision may have been personally repulsive to her, even though it was practiced all over the East. The Midianites circumcised, and Zipporah must have been familiar with it. She knew how to perform it. She did it on her own son. So I don't think she was angry because it was repulsive to her to have to perform the circumcision. She was angry because her son was about to get killed by Yahweh. Now we need to see, what does that phrase mean, bridegroom of blood? "You have become a bridegroom of blood to me." Here's option number one. From the love of Moses, she had risked the life of her child. By loving Moses, she had risked the life of her child. This is Jameson Fawcett Brown quoting John Calvin. In other words, "You are a bridegroom, Moses, that would have caused blood to be shed in my family. You are a bridegroom of blood. You are a bridegroom who's the origin and source of blood in my family. You are a bridegroom that I married that could have gotten one of my family killed, Moses." I think that's what it is. I think Calvin's right about that. Ellicott has another idea. He says that Zipporah is saying this, "Moses, after marrying you, I've had to circumcise both my sons." This, of course, would assume that Gershom, the older son, was circumcised earlier in Midian, and the son in this verse is Eliezer. And so Zipporah is saying, "You are a bridegroom of blood to me. I married you, you Hebrew, and you Hebrews circumcised on the eighth day, and now I got blood everywhere for my kids." Well, that's nice. Ellicott's, that's a good idea, but I don't think that's what it is. I think what she's saying, you have risked the life of my child when I married you, when you became my bridegroom, because you're a Hebrew that requires circumcision on the eighth day, and you didn't do it, and my son could have died, Moses. We go now to Exodus 4, verse 27. "Now the Lord said to Aaron, go to meet Moses in the wilderness. So he went and met him at the mountain of God and kissed him." Now this incident of the bloody foreskin happened on the way. I said on the way to Egypt. Apparently, this was still on the way to Mount Horeb, to Mount Sinai. He crossed over the north of the Gulf, tip of the north of Gulf of Aqaba, and headed to Mount Horeb, Mount Sinai. And Aaron had come out from Goshen to meet him there. So that's where we are now. Now, why did Aaron come? There's no other way except divine revelation. The Lord said to Aaron, go to meet Moses in the wilderness. Now, that could have come from some kind of a prophet or something, or it could have come through a dream. It could have come through, who knows how it came, but God communicated with his people. Notice how many direct revelations are necessary to work the very big miracle of the Exodus. God had to do a lot of stuff without violating the free will of the creature, but he intervened with miracles. That's how he gets his will done. He never violates our free will, but by golly, he does what's necessary to get done. As I said, Aaron was living in Goshen, which was not too far away from Mount Sinai. It was just one stop over between Sinai and Egypt proper. They were at the mountain of God. Why is Horeb, or Mount Sinai, Horeb? Why is it called the mountain of God? Well, because God had appeared to Moses there at Mount Horeb in the burning bush. That's what John Gill says. And I'm speculating here, this could be an anachronistic reference to God appearing later on the Exodus when God gave the law, but I don't think so. I think the mountain of God is because God appeared at the burning bush there at Mount Horeb. Now, Aaron kissed his brother. Now, that's something we don't do. We don't kiss our brothers, you know, but they did back then. That was cool. Aaron hadn't seen Moses for 40 years, as Jameson Foss and Brown point out. So that reunion might have been very emotional, very touching. We go now to Exodus chapter 4, verses 28 through 31. Moses told Aaron all the words of the Lord with which he had sent him, and all the signs that he had commanded him to do. Then Moses and Aaron went and assembled all the elders of the sons of Israel, and Aaron spoke all the words which the Lord had spoken to Moses. He then performed the signs in the sight of the people. So the people believed, and when they heard that the Lord was concerned about the sons of Israel and that he had seen their affliction, then they bowed low and worshipped. Now the signs here in verse 28 that the Lord had commanded Moses to do are the three signs to the Hebrews, not the 10 signs to the Egyptians. Sign number one, the rod, the snake, the rod. Sign number two, the good hand turns to a leper's hand, turns back to a good hand. Sign number three, the water of the Nile is turned to blood. Moses and Aaron went. It doesn't say exactly where they went. So options are they went to Goshen. That's where the Israelites were living. I think that's where they went. John Gill says, no, I went to Egypt's metropolis, whatever that was, maybe On, Hierapolis, present-day Cairo, in that same area there, right on the Nile, before the Nile splits into all the branches of the Nile. Gill speculates that because they very quickly went from that meeting, they went to see Pharaoh. I don't see any problem there. They just went from Goshen to see Pharaoh. Might have taken them a little while, but the text doesn't say anything about that. We can assume they had enough time to get to the capital city of Egypt, wherever it was. So I'm assuming that Aaron and Moses go to the Hebrew slaves in Goshen, northeastern Egypt. Now Zipporah and the two sons, Gershom and Eliezer, were eventually sent back to Midian on the way up on the Exodus. We read this, Exodus 18:2, Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Moses' wife Zipporah after he had sent her away. So they were safe, but they missed the Exodus. I don't know what I think about that. Moses lost his kids, his wife and two kids. Kind of sad, really. Now in verse 30, the text says, Aaron spoke all the words which the Lord has spoken to Moses. So now Aaron has become the spokesman for God, just like was like God said he was going to do in the verses we just went over. Now Adam Clark says that Aaron is likely better acquainted with Hebrew. I don't even know they were speaking Hebrew. Adam Clark assumes they were, but I remember looking on Wikipedia, linguists think that Hebrew started a lot later than this. The idea, whatever language the Hebrew slaves were speaking, they were speaking it, but they weren't speaking Egyptian. But Moses was brought up in an Egyptian home, so Egyptian was probably his native language, and so he might have been a little clumsy in his second language. Well, I had to stop recording here to look up on the internet to see when Hebrew started, and it says the first source I found said that evidence suggests that the Hebrew language was spoken on the Exodus. So apparently nobody knows for sure, but it's probably Hebrew. Well, if that's so, then Aaron's going to know Hebrew better than Moses because Moses grew up with Egyptian as his native language. But at any rate, Aaron is now the spokesman for Moses. Now, what was the response for that speech? Well, it's not only the speech, but Moses doing the three signs. The people believed. I'd believe, too, if I saw a rod turn into a snake and a leper's hand being healed and the water of the Nile turning to blood. Here's what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says about this. Formerly, they had slighted the message and rejected the messenger. Formerly, Moses had gone in his own strength. Now he goes leaning on God and strong only through faith in him who had sent him. Israel also had been taught a useful lesson, and it was good for both that they had been afflicted. The people, upon believing the signs, they bowed low in verse 31. The Eastern custom was to bow the head to the knees and then kneel down and touch the earth with the forehead, which Adam Clark says was a very painful and most humble posture. Another quote from Clark, "Those who pretend to worship God either by prayer or thanksgiving and keep themselves during the performance of those solemn acts in a state of perfect ease, either carelessly standing or stupidly sitting, surely cannot have a due sense of the majesty of God and their own sinfulness and unworthiness. Let the feelings of the body put the soul in remembrance of his sin against God. Let a man put himself in such a position, kneeling for instance, as it is generally acknowledged a criminal should assume, when coming to his sovereign and judge to bewail his sins and solicit forgiveness." You know, that sounds real pious and holy, but we're not criminals when we come before God. Once we're saved, we are the children of God, adopted sons who have confident access into his throne room. We don't go up there wailing our sins because our sins have been forgiven. We're not criminals that go before God. This is the typical 19th century balderdash that people always talked about, this sin consciousness so much that completely, in my opinion, ignores the powerful work that Christ's blood on the cross did in extinguishing our sin and not only forgiving us for the sin, but delivering us from the power of the sin. Well, with that little theological note, we have now finished Exodus 4. That prepares us for Exodus 5. We'll do the whole chapter next audio, verses 1 through 23, which I will call Making Bricks Without Straw. I hope you can be with us next time, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.